And Paolo was also my PhD advisor, and so he's a frequent visitor of PI. And so today he's giving a blackboard lecture about the equilibration in an isolated quantum system and the Loschmidt echo, and hopefully he'll also be able to show us some of the recent results.
So thank you very much for an introduction and for inviting me again. And I came here 1 year ago for a great conference that Alyosha organized. You know, it's that kind of conference where you have all the big names in the board and you're really, really agitated and nervous about your talk, so you want to relax down. And I think I did a great job of relaxing myself. And indeed, you know, I was so relaxed that over the talk I basically covered just one third of the material. Right? I said, okay, so this time I better be a little bit more agitated. And so I try to get myself agitated. And the way I do that is, hey, how about you go for a short board presentation? Okay? And then, well, it sounds strange because the other time I ran out of time, it was more likely that this will happen today, but we'll see what is going on. So it's going to be a simple lecture, no slides, and mostly aimed at a lot of students. I don't know whether there's any student here, but I will pretend that you guys are like my student back in LA. Okay? The title of the talk is Infinite Time Statistics and the Loschmidt Echo. It might sound a little technical. I'll try to make it non-technical as possible. But let me give you the background for this. The background is this revived interest that people have about equilibration dynamic and thermalization dynamics in many-body systems. When it turns out that there are quantum systems, namely isolated or nearly isolated quantum systems that are so supposed to evolve unitarily in time, that nevertheless, when you observe them, say measuring correlation functions or local observables, say in a cloud of ultra-cold atoms, you see that the asymptotic behavior in time resembles thermal behavior. Namely, you can compute those correlation functions or those expectation values using a canonical ensemble or microcanonical ensembles or even generalized canonical ensemble. But you know, if you think about it, and if you think about the general arguments that are put in favor to justify the emergence of thermal behavior or statistical mechanical behavior, none of those arguments seem to apply for a closed quantum system evolving unitarily. So somehow we have to make sense of this, and there's been a big deal of activity about that in the last 5 years or so, mostly triggered by these experiments on ultra-cold atoms, I would say. But, you know, theoreticians went wild because, after all, this is one of the most important, long-standing problems in theoretical physics, namely the foundation of statistical mechanics. So if you wish, this talk here today is about foundation of statistical mechanics. Of course, I'm going to address just a very particular subset of problems. I'm going to pick my own favorite observable and my own favorite system, and I'll try to say as much as I can about those. But nevertheless, I want you guys to be aware what is the big picture and the framework behind this effort puts itself. Okay? So let's start. Now that all of the higher is here, I can finally start writing the equation for you. So let's consider a closed quantum system. So all the relevant degrees of freedom are here in my system. So there's no environment around, or I can forget about interactions with the environment. Environment out there is out of interest. So if I start out of an initial state rho 0, time p equals 0, I'm going to write a general density matrix. It may well be a pure quantum state. This guy here will evolve according to the Hamiltonian of the system. So let me write the general evolution of the system in this way, where ut is the one-parameter dynamical group generated by some quantum Hamiltonian. So I'm going to say that this guy here is the exponential of minus I, dH, where H is a quantum level coming in, I'm going to focus myself on system with finitely many degrees of freedom, so my Hilbert space is going to be finite dimensional, though very large, and eventually maybe even approaching infinity. But you know, you have to think about the system as made up, for example, of L quantum spins, say L qubits, say a spin quantum chain of length L, each node of which you have a qubit sitting there. And then you realize, let me write the general Hamiltonian in this way, let me write the spectral decomposition for this guy. So this is a sum over N, the system is finite, I have a purely finite spectrum. The n are the eigenvalues, and pi n are the spectral projections of this other one. Okay? So this is my general setting. So the question I want to address first is the following. It's a trivial one. We all know the answer, but nevertheless, let me start slowly this way. Is there any chance that this mapping here has a limit for t going to infinity? So can we have a convergence in a unitary evolving system to some asymptotic limit quantum state? We all know the answer is going to be no. Let me review with you why this is so, or one way to think about this. So let's assume that it exists, a density matrix for all infinity, such that this is the limit for t goes to infinity of this unitary evolving set of density matrices. So if this is true, well, let me pick a norm in the space of distance, a metric in the space of density matrices, and of course, I'm going to pick, being a quantum information guy, I'm going to pick the trace norm. So if this is true, the following has to be true. That's rho t minus rho infinity norm 1. This guy here goes to 0 when t goes to infinity. This is just what this expression means. So now let's make this simple observation. If rho infinity is a limit point of this dynamics, it's a fixed point. It's easy to see that this guy has to be a fixed point. So let me write this saying that this belongs to the set of fixed points of the one parameter evolution group. If this is true, then we can write this expression in the following way. Ut rho naught minus rho infinity ut delta. Right? I used both the definition of rho t and the definition of rho infinity, or the property of rho infinity being a fixed point of the dynamics. But then, as we all know, all these norms here are unitary invariant, and so this is nothing but rho 0 minus rho infinity. So this is actually a constant. So there's just one. If this guy has to go to 0 for t going to infinity, the only possibility is that this guy has been 0 all along. Right? So rho infinity is the limit point of a unitary dynamics. You have to add the rho 0. It turns out to be rho t for all possible t equal to rho infinity is a fixed point. So this is what we all knew. Unitary evolving system, they don't have non-trivial limit points. The only limit points are fixed points of the dynamics.
Excuse me, but your assumption that the Hilbert space is finite dimensional.
This proof here doesn't
make any sense. So it holds the basic rest of our.
Yeah, this is absolutely for any infinite dimension. Just consider the Banach space of trace class operators. And this has to be a strongly continuous group of unitary evolutions. Okay? Yeah. Let me characterize this set of fixed points. Are the unlimited points allowed. So first, this is the set of states, so just the node state by row. Then, as we know, they commute with the elements of the one parameter group for all possible values of t. And another characterization of this guy here is the following. This is the range, so I call the image, the following super operator that is associated with the Hamiltonian, where this superoperator is the so-called defacing superoperator. It just kills the off-diagonal elements in the energy representation, if you wish. So it takes any linear operator x, well, is the image of dx of the set of states. This is what I mean. You apply dh, defined in the following way, I n x by n, and this is what you get. Okay, so this is the algebraic characterization of this set of fixed points. Another way to write this guy here, but this is particularly interesting if you want to make the dynamics more explicit, so to speak, is the following. That is the following characterization that is known by the von Neumann ergodic theorem, that again it holds true in for whatever dimension, just for strongly continuous group of unitaries, as the limit for capital T that goes to infinity, 1 over T integral 0, capital T, little t, ut, x, dt. Namely, is the time average of the Heisenberg evolving x. Okay, let me write this guy introducing the notation that we'll use a lot in the following day. Okay? Good. In particular, you can ask yourself, well, what happens if rho in my initial preparation is a pure state? Well, it's trivial to see. Well, it's very easy to see. And in this case, the only possibility is, of course, the only fixed points that are the same at the same time, they are pure states. So if rho is equal to rho squared and rho belongs to fixed view, then rho has to be the one-dimensional projection on an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so we know this stuff. Just wanted to remind you. So there's no way that in any strong operator norm sense there's a conversion to anything. Okay? So we have to look for something else if we are sort of trying to address this problem of equilibration, of tending somehow to some equilibrium or wannabe equilibrium state. Well, the next thing you want to check after you ruled out the possibility of strong convergence, you want to check whether it's possible some sort of weak convergence. Namely, well, this is what they do in experiments, right? They don't really do the quantum state tomography. They don't really measure the whole density matrix of this many body system. What they really do, they pick a bunch of preferred observables, like, say, local observables, momenta, or stuff like that, energy densities or particle density, and they basically observe the expectation values over time. So the next thing you want to check is whether it's possible that if we define, okay, let be A an observable. So an Hermitian operator over the Hilbert space. Let me define the following real value function, t alpha t, that is just a time-dependent expectation value. Okay, so we want to see whether this quantity here may converge, okay, because this is what may happen. Let's see whether this is possible, okay. Again, this is elementary stuff, right? Well, again, I resort to the spectral decomposition of my Hamiltonian. That is, in a couple of moves, you'll see that this is just n, well, let's get very right, pi n rho 0 pi n a times an exponential guy, an oscillating factor exponential with the Bohr frequencies of the system, namely the difference between the eigenstate, the eigenvalues of your problem. So let me just compress the two indices n and m in a single index p, just for the sake of notational simplicity. So you're going to write this guy here as a sum over a discrete set, as long as the dimensions are finite, of some amplitudes, possibly complex amplitude, that they contain information about the initial state as well as the matrix element of the observable you're trying to measure, times a set of frequencies, okay, they're just the Bohr frequencies of this guy here, first omega p is just en minus en. And again, the question in this weak set up. Is this guy going to, at the limit for t going to infinity? Is there any chance? T to infinity? Well, now you think about it for a second, and as long as I said, the dimensions are finite, this is a sum over a discrete number of frequencies. You know, this is a well-known kind of function. It's called quasi-periodic function. And quasi-periodic function, no matter how much you wish them to have a limit, they won't have a limit for you. Okay? Because for whatever epsilon, for whatever small quantity you may want to pick, there's always a capital T, a time, such that this alpha, this function here, at time capital T, will get arbitrarily close to its initial value. It may take a long while, but time scales are not an issue here. I'm not addressing any time scale problem here. Warning, disclaimer. It's very interesting. It's a very tough problem. Other people try to do. Remarkably, actually, Alyosha has a recent paper addressing precisely the relaxation time. I'll mention, I'll tell you what we mean by relaxation time a little later on. But this is not the goal of my talk. So it doesn't matter. We know that this guy here, it may have strong oscillations at the beginning. There may be tiny fluctuations. And it may look like that the coarse grain observer got a limit. But eventually, there will be spikes. And eventually, we'll go pretty much all the way back. Please.
EFP could dampen the thing, the matrix element.
Could dampen, yeah. And it may decide to dampen, but this function is quasi-periodic. So at some point you will have revivals, right?
Whatever may be EFP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Actually, you can. Well, what you can do, you say, hey, how about that? How about I move to infinite dimensions? In this case, there's no longer a point spectrum. You may have a continuous spectrum. And then it's not hard to see that using stuff like standard result, like the Lebesgue lemma, this stuff here, and it may have some limit. Okay? So if you first take the thermodynamic limit, L goes to infinity, L is the number of subsystems, and then the T equal to infinity limit, in this case, you know, this makes the difference. In this case, you may have some convergence of some observable. Okay, but of course this convergence is not going to be uniform over all possible observables, because otherwise it would imply the strong convergence that we ruled out just out of the elementary property of unitary evolution. Okay, so this is just to say we got to do something else. If equilibration, if we set out in order to make sense of the notion of equilibration, we have to try something else. Okay, let's see what this. Is this something else, or at least there's something else we have tried, okay? So, from now on, I want to think about these observables here. I'm going to call an observable just the time-dependent expectation value of some observable, some quantum permission operator. I want to think about these guys here as random variables defined over the real axis, where the real axis is the timeline, okay? So it's a map from the timeline to the top, to the real numbers. So, and in order to turn this into a random variable, what I have to do is to tell you what is the probability space I start out, namely giving you a measure on the real line, right? Let me do that, and I'm going to pick a measure. Okay. See, apply some physical fitness giving talks here, and. Let me tell you that I want to quit. I'm going to think about the real line, the real timeline, as a probability space with the following measure. The measure, so I'm going to tell you which are the measurable sets, and they're the back measurable set, that they have defined in the following way. If A is a subset of R, I'm going to say that mean of A is what I call the time. So where chi A is just the indicator function of the set A. So mainly is 1 T belongs to A and is 0 otherwise. Okay, if T doesn't belong to A. So if you wish, this is just, well sorry, I'm missing of course a crucial 1 over T. So this just means this for this measure here, in order for a cell to have a non-vanishing measure has to be infinite, right? And it's just basically the fraction of elements in T, the fraction of real time instant that they fall into A, right? So for this is a very, as I, let me do the same joke I made 1 year ago, this is a, just a very spiritual kind of measure because just eternity matters. And this is why in all the considerations that will follow, basically I won't be able to make any assessment or any claim about time scales, okay? Because I'm just looking really, so this is the infinite time thing that was in my time, okay? Well, okay, so
why? Sorry, instead of being very general, if you restrict to rho zero, which is very close to, say, ground state, then you may be able to go farther and time scales may come.
I think this is a very good suggestion, and I think the second part of my talk is all about that. It's that good that, you know, I mean, I love that. Absolutely. We'll see. Well, and we'll see whether it should watch you anymore. Okay, so let me say that my goal here is now, given the observable alpha, I want to try to characterize the probability or the probability density P alpha over the entire timeline that is defined in the following ways. Just delta alpha minus alpha T average over T. If somehow I were able to capture at least some of the main features of this quantity here, I would be able to learn quite a big deal about the behavior, the asymptotic, and the infinite time statistics of this observable here. For example, I may compute the moments. The first moment, the time average of my quantity, this is going to be delta alpha alpha p alpha, or even the higher moments, for what matters, alpha n t, and this is, of course, going to be delta alpha alpha n. Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna try to learn as much as possible, or that would be the dream, about given whatever observable A about this PA. Okay, the infinite time probability distribution density for the observable. And I don't think it's hard to realize that it conveys a lot of experimental significance, okay, meaning. Okay, let me jump thing. Let's start by computing, or try to see how the lower moments look like, right? So let's start by the first moment, namely, well, let me call V1, namely alpha T. First theorem, and this is an old theorem. This thing here, and it's not actually, you know, if you look at this expression here, now I want to just take the time average of this guy here. It's not hard to guess what's going to happen, at least for point spectrum. All the terms were, let's look at this, where omega p is different from zero, they oscillate, and they will be averaged out. So all terms where omega p is different from zero are killed by the time averaging, and what you're left with is just the remaining terms, namely those for which AP corresponding to those P that where omega p is zero. Let's assume the spectrum here is not, well, I don't have to do that, right? So I just have to sum over all APs where omega p is equal to zero, and what you find is this trace, omega bar is the time average density matrix that I'm gonna write, unsurprisingly, like T dH, the phasing operator acting on rho. Okay, now you see why I wanted to introduce this guy here, because clearly, you know, when you get rid of all the terms but those where n is equal to n, what you're left is precisely the phased density matrix. Again, time average killed the phase relation between different branches of the wave function evolving according to different algorithms.
So this is what we call rho zero, the initial.
No, this is not rho zero. This, what are
the rho is inside the dH.
Absolutely. Sorry. Thank you. This is rho zero. Okay, nice. Well, this again, before you ask, let me tell you that this result holds very general, is infinite dimension, and again, unsurprisingly, John von Neumann proved it. Okay? Actually, most of what I'm going to tell you has been proved by John von Neumann. and independently 8 years after by somebody else. And my sergeant can do that. Good. So this is the first moment. Now this is just expectation value of my observable, my A, with respect to given density matrix, namely the time average density matrix. Now, is this going to be enough? Well, no, because, of course, let's draw a picture. Supposedly saying there's more, 1,000, more than 1,000 words, another word for me, but I know people say that. Okay, so you have alpha p, you start out with some, you know, alpha zero, and then you have some fluctuation, stuff like that, and it goes something like this forever, right? You may have, so this is alpha bar, and the hope, so this is the time average. The hope is that if somehow we can put bounds on the fluctuations, on the time fluctuations, in such a way that this, you know, that the amplitude of the spikes here around the average is small, then we can say, hey, well, it's true that this system is evolving unitarily, it never stops, never really converges to anything, but for most, for all practical purposes, if the amplitude of those fluctuations is sufficiently small and becomes experimentally indistinguishable from its time average, namely, we can sort of say that, that my quantum state has evolved towards rho bar, the time average. So the time average describes actually what happens on the, at least for infinite times in your system. So you want to put the next thing you want to do, if this is the hope, you want to make sure, you want to check out how big are those fluctuations. So in order to compute the fluctuation, you want to check the variance of this guy here. So the variance alpha, of course, is just, well, is mu 2, the second moment, minus mu 1 squared, namely alpha squared, t average over time. Okay? Is that right? Good. So, theorem, proved by Peter Riemann in 2007, and as I said, independently by John von Neumann in 1929, it's independently, I'm pretty sure. If A is a bounded operator, okay, let me assume that the operator norm of this guy is bounded. So let me solve this. This guy here is bounded above by this trace rho bar square, namely by the operator norm of your, the observable you're monitoring over time, times the purity, this is what we quantum information guy call the trace of the square of the density matrix, the purity of this, the phase or time average density matrix. So now we see what is the idea. If we can show that this typically, for most of the initial preparations and for most of the reasonable interaction Hamiltonians, this guy here is small, this puts a bound on the fluctuation, and then we can say that somehow most of the times you expect your observable to be close to the time average. So let's make this a little bit more precise.
Do you want a square on the norm of the A?
I want a square. Thank you very much, Rafael. Of course, even dimensions. You check dimensions. Get it, a square. Thank you. I always forget that square. Okay, so let me make a little more precise. And I won't attempt to write the name because I'm not sure about how it spells out the Chebyshev inequality. That is, it depends on the title. Chebyshev, you know,
the
Russian dude?
Yes. Well, Yasha has a Russian name.
Yeah. Well, but he's spelled in an Italian way.
Yes.
That's sort of a figure it out. So, the Chebyshev inequality says that the probability that the observable alpha, the random variable alpha, minus alpha bar is larger than k sigma, where sigma is the variance of this guy here, is smaller than 1 over k squared. Chebyshev inequality, one of the basic results in elementary probability theory. What does this do for us? Well, it does a lot. Because if now we can prove that in some limit, say in the large system size limit, sigma goes to 0, and k goes to infinity, but in such a way that k times sigma goes to zero. So for example, we can do this by taking like k example, 1 over square root of sigma, to say something. Okay, you can prove that for whatever this would imply, that for whatever epsilon, whatever delta, the probability that this guy here fluctuates away from the average for more than epsilon is smaller than delta. Okay? And this is a convergence measure result. It's telling you that the random variable alpha, let me put a little label here, the system size, because this is what I really have in mind when I'm saying taking limits. Alpha t, L is a real number. This set converges in measure to the constant random variable alpha bar, right? So it gets totally concentrated. So we have a measure concentration phenomena in the large system size. Okay? So this is what I aim at. So what I want to say, if you wish, is that to me, the convergence to equilibrium or the thermalization, or I should better say, equilibration of the quantum system, is a sort of measure convergence kind of phenomena related to observables. Okay? And I'll try to make this... now I'll start the second part of my talk, where I start to study a specific quantity. Okay, I want to try to address the big problem, you know, A could be whatever. Of course, we are mostly, as a physicist, interested in sort of variables like local variables in a multipartite system and this sort of results. But I try to keep my considerations fairly general, and in order to do so, now I'm going to focus, okay? So I want to try to find general results. In order to find general results, you can find general results on a smaller subset. Does it make sense? Yes. Okay, that's it. So now I introduce the other name that was in my top title, and this I've lost the thing. And it is the Loschmidt echo. So Loschmidt, as you may know, it was a contemporary of Ludwig Boltzmann. Actually, the two guys they had quite a few fights. Okay? And Loschmidt. Loschmidt hasn't introduced the quantity I'm going to write down, but somehow morally, this is what he wanted to do with. It was challenging. That's why it was challenging the statistical views about mechanics of Boltzmann. Like you now invert all the velocities of the particles in your gas. Okay, you wanted sort of to invert the dynamics of the system. Well, for the sake of time, I can't quite tell you what is the relation of these quantities I'm going to write in a second to this Loschmidt argument, but this one. For sure, and if you want, I'll tell you in private later on. It's not that far, actually. So let me define the Loschmidt echo, LT, in the following way. LT is just... So let me start out... Let me say that my rho zero is just... Psi is the one-dimensional projection. I start out with a pure quantum state. And I'm going to consider the overlap of the time-evolving state psi t with psi zero. And I take the square of this guy here. Right? It's a sort of dynamical fidelity between the state of time t equals zero and the state of time t. It's useful to see that this expression here can be written in the following way. Sum over n, and again is labeled in the energy eigenstate, Pn e minus e. Pn t, where Pn are, let me assume for the sake of simplicity that my Hamiltonian has one-dimensional projections, namely the spectrum is not degenerate. It's not really necessary, but I'll do that. Where the Pn are the probability, is the probability distribution of the initial state over the energy eigenbasis of the evolving Hamiltonian. Okay? This is what the Pns are. And once you write this guy in this way, it's not difficult to realize that this is a Fourier transform of a probability distribution that I'm going to call probably delta H omega, like this, where this is this delta H, let me put another side here, is the so-called local density state, so projective density state, and this is just the initial state, delta omega minus H. This may sound like a technical remark, but it's kind of useful to realize the velocity tape itself is the square of the modulus of the Fourier transform of a probability distribution, because this is a probability distribution, the local or the projected density of state. And so even its square is going to be, so we call that the Fourier transform of a probability distribution, we call that the characteristic function of that probability distribution. And even the product of two characteristic functions is still a characteristic function. It's actually the characteristic function of the convolution of the two distribution density, okay, of the two probability density. Keep that this in mind for the time, okay? It's a nice thing to notice. But, well, this is my object. Well, what does it do? Well, obviously, again, let me draw a picture again. It starts t equals 0. It starts out at 1. And drops down. Well, there will be a lot of interesting things to say about the wave drops now, the short time behavior and the sort of things, then it starts to oscillate, then it gets tiny oscillations that may look like it stabilized, it converges, and if you wait long enough, you start to see spikes, and then bigger spikes, and eventually, at an astronomically large time scale known as, of course, Poincaré recurrence time, it jumps all the way back. These little spikes here were again some of its original amplitude are called revivals, and Alyosha Hama has, for example, studied how these things scale with the system size and whether and how and the relation with the Hamiltonian being in a gap or in a quantum critical phase. Okay, so these are the revivals. And much later we have this guy here, the recurrence. And if you wish, the time it takes to jump from the initial value 1 to the tiny, or to this sort of time average thing, the time it takes to get down from 1 to there, is called the relaxation time. I have nothing to offer you today, guys, about this, but again, well, out there, and even in papers of ours, there are results about it. Okay? Good, so this is the Loschmidt-Tenko. Let's see what we can say about this. So it's my observation. From now on, this is the man. And you will see why I want to pick this. And okay, let me write this in yet another way, just to show that it's a weird observable, because of course we are used to observables being states being linear in the density matrix, well, this is quadratic in the density matrix, okay? But nevertheless, you can think about this as just an observable in a higher dimension, in a doubled Hilbert space. Let me show you what I mean by this. It's easy to see that this guy here can be written in the following way. Psi is just the initial grounds, is the initial state. 2, and then let me write it this way, ut curly u acting on s. So curly u is just the adjoint action. Actually, it's the adjoint action with the vendor. And s is a swap operator, is the so-called swap operator. As you have noticed, I played the tensor power trick. I enlarge my Hilbert space, I double it. And so this guy here, It's just the map. It's just this map here. Okay. Well, it's easy to check. It's a well-known trick in quantum information for quadratic expression. You linearize them moving to a tensor power. Why I'm writing this? Because now you see in principle what you want to do in order to measure psi, to measure L. You prepare two copies of your system. You let them evolve in the following way. You evolve with QT the first copy of it. You do nothing to the second copy. Well, now I move to the Heisenberg picture, but of course you can flip over the states. And then I measure S namely the term in its expectation value, because this is nothing but, well, if you read this quantum circle here, it does what this formula says. Okay, so this is the experiment, if you wish, or at least the experiment as seen by hardcore theoreticians like him, okay? This is what you have to do. S is a unitary operator, but of course it squares with the identity, so it's Hermitian as well, so it's a fully fledged observable that, for example, the spin system may relate to the Heisenberg interaction between different distances. Okay? So this is our experiment how to measure the loss negator. So it's a slightly more complicated. Okay, let's do that. Let's move on and let's try to compute momenta of this probability distribution, because my goal is still to find, to know as much as possible about this probability distribution density for this. And actually, let me tell you something. That, well, the first thing you do, well, now I'm keeping everything, all the discussion pretty abstract, but what we did, of course, was different. We picked a very specific system. We picked the XY chain, so a collection, well, everybody does, okay, and we did as well. The XY chain is a one-dimensional system of spin one up, so qubits, and they're interacting with some nearest neighbor Isaac interaction along the X and the Y direction, possibly different, plus a transverse magnetic field along the Z direction. This is a very interesting model because it's solvable, and it's always nice. Actually, it can be mapped into free fermions, a quadratic fermionic Hamiltonian through the Jordan-Wigner transformation. And Sadler has a trivial, in spite of the simplicity, he has a very non-trivial phase diagram, and namely there are quantum phase transitions in there as a function of the control parameters in your system that may be the external magnetic field, as well as the anisotropy parameter that is weighting different the two Ising couplings along the X and the Y direction. Okay, I'm not going to write it, I'm not telling you. But this is what we did. And we did experiments, numerical experiments, right? What do you do? Well, you just plot. You compute your Loschmidt taker, and you do your histograms, because of course, practically computing this probability distribution function is checking histograms, and we observe a Loschmidt taker phenomenology. It is the following. So actually, let me say what we were doing. The initial state was the ground state of the XY chain for some value of the magnetic field, say lambda 1. Then, all of a sudden, we let the system evolve according to a new Hamiltonian that is the same XY model with a different value of the external magnetic field. Namely, we did what is popular these days as a quantum quench. Okay, and depending on how big the quench was, namely how big was the jump from the initial Hamiltonian, whose the initial state was the ground state of, and your evolving Hamiltonian, you would observe different things. So for a large quench, or anyways, for if the system size were large enough, our probability distribution looked like something like this. So the time average was going to be very small, and you expect that. Think about it, and I'll make it more clear. And it was short, so very small, actually exponentially small in the number of elements. And so it's something that tended to be like here, squeezed against the y-axis, and the probability distribution looks some sort of exponential guy. Large quench or large system size. Something like PL x minus L over its average. Then we did something different. We considered small quench. So we prepare the system in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and we let the evolving Hamiltonian to be just slightly off of the initial one, just a little change in the coupling strength, same external magnetic field. In this case, right, if the quench is very, very small, actually, if the quench were zero, of course, you know, this would be a fixed point, okay, no evolution. But instead, and if you make the quench small, you expect something that is quite not typical. Actually, doing small quenches is moving away from typicality. I'll make this more clear in a moment. But if you do this small quench thing, the expectation value of your Loschmidt table, you don't expect to be very small, actually should be fairly close to one. Actually, in the limit that the quench goes to zero, has to go back to one, so has to go close to one. And the probability distribution for this small quenches, I'm sorry, I have to get more organized, let me still right here. We had two possibilities, very intriguing. First, what actually we always expected, a Gaussian distribution. Well, this is supposed to be a Gaussian, or this is L bar, where L bar was close to 1, let me say was close. And if the quench was small and nearby criticality, we found a very differential. How can it turn out to be universal? So we checked that for many other systems, and the shape was the following. Again, the around expectation value, something like this. Double pit structure that I named the Batman hood, right? It was by the ears of Batman. And actually, if you check the archive, I'm very proud to say that if you check the name, if you find for Batman in the quantum pH archive, you will find our paper. Well, I thought it was a major accomplishment. And the paper went through the referee process and like has published this paper. And it was, and I'm going to be the first man adding the Batman in an APS paper. But when you receive the proofs, the Batman hood was replaced by a double gift distribution. Yeah, I guess it's some copyright with DC Comics or something. But anyway, so this is small quenches of criticality, criticality. Okay, can we understand these different universal shapes of the probability distribution? Do they convey, as it seems, information about the spectrum of your system, namely being a gap or being critical, on the size of the system? Okay? So this was the general kind of question that we wanted to address.
Small quench and close to criticality will lead to orthogonality catastrophe. And then where does it appear in this?
Yeah, actually this is a manifestation of your, it's somehow a manifestation. I do agree it's perfect, and actually we did a lot of work about how to characterize. Let me go. Very good, very, absolutely very good. Very glad that you asked this. So let's see. So this was the phenomenology, right? Actually, I'm supposed to have just 10 minutes, right?
Well, yeah, 15, because you started 10 minutes.
Well, I'm not going to make
it. Those,
even this time.
What is the horizontal axis and what is the vertical axis?
So this is L. So the value of the motion you take when you observe, and this, I'm sorry, this is PL.
So this is a sort of histogram for the...
Yeah. Is this guy, is the guy I want to compute. It's a probability distribution for it. So this is a histogram that in the lens where, you know, you make your bins very, very small, it gives the probability distribution, the statistics of the motion you take. And the idea was that we can capture a lot of physics just looking at the universal shapes of the probability distribution. Okay? Well, let's
so do that, in particular, the first one you showed with the large quench. That's not a function of time. That's
no. It's again L.
That's again the
L. It's the probability distribution for a large quench, nearly or exponentially looking, Gaussian for a small quench, and of criticality, and the double peak or Batman hood kind of thing for near criticality.
So intuitively, this means if you just sample it at a random time, what's
this,
the value?
This one. This is precisely the way we computed this study. We had explicit analytic forms. I'm not going to bug you. We would add a lot of explicit analytic forms of these guys for a specific system. I want to keep this discussion, you know, pretty abstract in a way. Okay, it's a perimeter institute. Okay. I think it can do it.
So it's a general feature, or just also for these spin systems?
This is what the talk is about. Okay, the answer is general. Okay. But though that phenomenology was at least at the beginning just for that model, right? So it was the question. So let's look at LT. LT, well, you expand that square, PN, P minus P, T. Then let's do time average. Again, the off-diagonal terms are killed. The only thing you have is sum over n, pn squared. Pn squared, so this is again the trace of the purity of the phase state. Nice! It was precisely what showed up in the right-hand side of the Riemann theorem, right? So if now we can show that this guy here, at least typically, is very small, Namely, if the Loschmidt echo time average is very small, then we know that for most of the observables, or bounded observables, they would thermalize in this sense, having very tiny fluctuations around their minimum. Okay. So the question is, how big is this typically? Well, let me go real quick about this. You can infer this is a function of the initial state. It seems to me, even seem an ill-posed question, but still, you can think as about this guy here, this L bar, mu1, so well, is the first moment of the Loschmidt echo. Let me write it in a slightly different way, that is just using this swap thing. And I can write this, right, psi. I make explicit the initial preparation, dh2 acting on s. Then we can take the average. So this is a quantity that we can take the average over the entire unit ball of the Hilbert space to see how big or how large is typically. Well, we find first the average value, and then if the average value is small, since this is a positive quantity, even its fluctuations have to be small. I'm here referring to the Markov inequality, right? It's just another version, if you wish, of the Chebyshev inequality. For a positive quantity, if the average is small, since, you know, its downward fluctuations are bounded below by the real axis, okay, even the upward fluctuation gotta be small. So for a positive random variable, having a small average is enough to say that the eigen extremely concentrated, right? So the Loschmidt echo is the same, and same thing. If I prove that this is average, its time average is very small, then I know that it's concentrated in time. If I prove that this guy here, seen as a random variable from the Hilbert space, unit ball, equipped with the Haar measure, the unitary invariant measure, if I show that this guy here is small, well, this is, you know, this has small fluctuation and is highly concentrated. And for most of the initial preparation, the Hilbert-Schmidt, the Loschmidt echo average is small, so it's temporally concentrated. Okay? So this average here theorem can be computed resorting to some, now I'm averaging over the initial state preparation, doing the Haar measure average of this, and this turns out to be for all possible Hamiltonians. If I call d, little d, the dimension of my space, it actually is little, but it's supposed to be large because my system is supposed to be composed out of n little subsystem, turns out to be d plus 1, 2d plus 1. This is an exact result, and so this goes like 2d minus 1. If you now think about d like a spin or a qubit system, say that typically the Loschmidt echo average value is exponentially small in the number of subsystems, in the number of space. We could make this result even stronger using other arguments.
And this is regardless of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And this is very...
This is very cute. But it's, well, you know, it's very cute, but if you think time averaging over the old unit ball, it's basically, it makes all everything look the same somehow. So it's cute, yeah, but I can share details of this. This is a cute three-line calculation as soon as you're able to do time, you know, hard measure averages. Good, so this is very small. This is the typical case, though.
So this must be unique for global quench.
This is a global...
If you had some local quench...
No. Here in this, there's no notion of locality of global.
Because you're changing the parameter of the Hamiltonian.
Yes. I understand what you mean, but in this particular result, there's no distinction.
It doesn't depend on the Hamiltonian.
It doesn't depend on the Hamiltonian.
Regardless of what is the Hamiltonian.
Well, there are some assumptions that, of course, I was careful not to share with you, like non-degeneracy of the Hamiltonian or non-macroscopic degeneracy. There are fine grains, right, that I'm sure you will check in my papers. Okay? In our papers, I should better say. Okay, but this is the typical case. Away from typicality, for example, for a small quench, I don't expect this to be the case, because this is saying that the time average is exponentially small. Well, I just told you, hey, if the quench is small, it's got to be close to 1. So let's see it. So let's move here. So tell me when I'm left with 5 minutes. Like now.
In 1 minute.
Well, I guess this is like...
But by the way, we are not very strict.
You are now very strict. Thank you for
that. People seem to be enjoying it. They want to know the end of it.
Okay, so let's look at the time average for the small punch case. Small punch, I mean, the bi-holding gamma-lutonia is some H naught, locally interacting gamma-lutonia, plus perturbation. So I mean that the operator of H naught is big O1, is order 1 term, while the norm of V is like the small order epsilon, right, in this way, where epsilon is supposed to be infinitesimal, right? So there's a perturbation on my system. If this is the case, then we know, well, we write this, this is P0. So this is the probability that the of the initial state over the eigenstate of the ground. So I'm going to order the energy eigenstate like 0, 1, 2, 3, increasing order of energy. So 0 labels the ground state. P0 is just the overlap between the ground state of the evolving gamma-lutonian H and the original ground state. So this guy here, P0, the normalization is simply this. This guy here is order 1. And then I have all the other guys. N larger than zero, Pn squared, and now I'm using perturbation theory, if you wish. These are given by this expression here. Energy gaps, so these guys here are like order epsilon squared. So let me say that I can kill these guys, and I just gotta keep P0, okay? Because this is by far the leading term here. And P0, actually, we can write like 1 minus all this guy, n greater than 0, Pn squared, and again, this is 1 minus 2, this quantity here, that I'm going to call chi f. This quantity here, as it turns out, is a quantity that played a big role in the so-called fidelity approach to quantum phase transition, that is a sort of theoretical effort that my collaborators and I, plus I have to say many other people by now, tried in the last years to, quantum information is yet another quantum information approach to quantum phase transition, which is related to the orthogonality catastrophe. So maybe I address this in this way. So this quantity here, chi f, that is just it's just the sum of these pn's, so it's going to be chi f, that is known as fidelity susceptibility, is n greater than 0, and v, the matrix element between the ground state and excited state of the original Hamiltonian over this, and you can prove and reprove the following theorem that this quantity here for a gamma system goes like order of L, where L is the linear system size, where I should say is the volume, but we have primarily in mind one-dimensional system, even though the result is by no means guessed. While for critical systems, where H naught, I'm perturbing my system around the critical point, we have what was named some sort of orthogonality catastrophe. So this is case like two dimension of the system. Now little d is the spatial dimension of the system. Z is the dynamical exponent, and delta is the scaling dimension of this guy here. What doesn't matter if you got the details of this. The part is that when the scaling dimension is smaller than, actually when it's smaller than z plus d over 2, it's easy to check that this guy here is super extensive. Right? This is for global quench. This is for global quench, otherwise we may have different logarithmic behavior and stuff like that. So this means with this fidelity may be super divergent at criticality, and this saying that when if you move from your ground state parameter lambda you are Hamiltonian and you take the overlap, you slightly change your parameter, so your computer is called the ground state fidelity between the two ground states associated to the different set of parameters. It turns out that this is 1, minus, well, let me write in another way, is the exponential of minus delta lambda square times chi f. So you see that of criticality, the decay as a function of the system size of the ground state overlap goes at most linearly with the system size, namely is an extensive quantity, while you may have an enhanced greater orthogonality rate, orthogonalization rate for in the thermodynamical limit when you're sitting at criticality. So it means this is what I would call the orthogonality catastrophe. Okay? Just computing the fidelity of this ground state here. Well, but this was supposed to be a digression, and I think now it's supposed to be done, right? How about we keep going for... This is for you, so if you leave, I'm going to stop. So, right? Down here.
Let's go for some more minutes.
Some more minutes, right? Okay, good. So let me show what we are trying to do with this Schwarzschild. So typically it's large, it's very small, it's exponentially small, and so it's exponentially concentrated in the system size. But when you are away from criticality, it is not. But let's see, because its average is close to 1, and the deviation from 1 is parametrized by the fidelity susceptibility, it may get a little large for super extensive, as a matter of fact, for critical systems. Let's try to reason a little bit. Let's use words. Let's see whether I can make it faster. So the Loschmidt-Eco is the Fourier transform of the probability of a DOS, the density of state, right? It's the Fourier transform of that. So if you have a non-interacting system, say quasi-free fermionic system, and we work them out entirely, you expect your local density of state being a convolution, your projective density of state for an initial a factorized state, you expect your density of state being a convolution of the individual subsystem density of state. So your Loschmidt-Eco is going to be a problem. Well, trivial. If your system is factorizable, your Loschmidt-Eco is going to be a problem. Okay. If your system is not really factorizable, it's just a weakly interacting system, you still expect, for continuity theorems for the density of state, your density, local density of state, being close to close to convolution, so your Loschmidt-Eco being close to a problem. And when you have a product of infinitely many variables, or a large number of variables, because of course you have as many terms in the product, as many degrees of freedom in your system, say capital L, the right thing to look at is the log of something. If you want to prove a theorem about the probability distribution of something, what is the most general and powerful result we have? It's the central limit theorem that say that whenever your random variable is going to be a sum of a large number of random identically distributed, or not necessarily even identically distributed, of random variables with global bounded, total bounded variance for L that goes to infinity, they converge to the normal distribution. So Loschmidt-Eco looks like a product. It's a fidelity, after all. And so let's try to look at the log. So let me give you the last 5 minutes. I'll try to argue about the log of this guy here. For a small quench, in our paper, we proved this rigorously. Well, I don't know whether communication and mathematical physics would have said that, but at least PRL should. Okay, we proved that rigorously for quasi-free system or XY chain. But I want to sketch the general argument here with you just to close nicely, hopefully. So let me look at the log. Log of t, okay, this is log p squared. So it is the sum of the squares plus the of the diagonal term that I'm going to write n smaller than n, pn, cos omega n, where omega n, of course, are just the Bohr frequencies in the system. So this is exact. So now I'm going to say that we are in the small quench. The leading order term is just p naught. So I'm going to say that this is the log p0 squared plus, so I'm going to get rid of all the higher order terms in the perturbation, n larger than 0, p naught pn cos en. So the frequencies over the ground state energy, like this. So then you can factorize out P0 naught. And so this is log P0 square plus, well, is the log of 1 plus all these little guys here, because they are small, because they are in the perturbative regime. So I can say that this is the sum over 2 Pn. I set here P0 to 0. Trust me, this is OK. Pn plus P0. Look, we're here. So we have a constant term. You can forget about it. And it's just the log of the purity. So namely, is the 2 Rényi entropy of the phase state. Mike, it's kind of cute. It's there, but we don't care about this guy right here, right now. And then you have a bunch of oscillating terms. Let's now make the general, the assumption that is fairly mild in a way, that all these omega n, namely the En minus the E0, are rationally independent. So these guys here, and this is generically true, right? So these guys here now are a bunch of random variables over a torus, because these phases here are moving on a torus. If they are rationally independent, they're going to be uniform over the torus. So I can replace every time ever. I can use ergodic theorem in one of those cases where ergodic theorem is known to hold for sure. Okay, namely rationally independent motion over a torus, a d-dimensional torus, and I can replace all these averages here by phase averages. Okay, I replace time average by phase average in this case. So this looks we are pretty much done. So it looks like the log of the Loschmidt is going to be a normal variable, because it's a sum of many terms. Many, well, I guess it depends on the distribution of the pn, but apparently many terms of random variables, each of them has a variance. So this is a random, the cosine is a random variable over the over. So let me call this guy here the torus xn of t, or I should say xn of alpha, if I denote by alpha just the argument of the cosine, namely the parameter in the torus. So it's a sum of all these random independent variables whose total variance is going to be sum over n. Well, you know, this is a cosine, so when you do the time average, the variance is going to be p squared over 2, and so we have a 2 squared here, we have the 2 in front, so the total variance of this guy here is pn, is the sum of the pn squared, and again, being all of these guys is more than 1, this is bounded above by pn, n larger than 0, notice that this thing here, n can be larger than 0, I sort of factorized the mode. And so this is again the fidelity susceptibility. So the total variance of this bunch of oscillating random variables is bounded above by the fidelity susceptibility that itself, of criticality, is bounded, is generally bounded by L. So this is one of the conditions for the central limit theorem to hold. So namely that the total variance of the random variables you're summing up is bounded by some constant times the number of total variables, and actually turns out, well, this is just a lower bound, even at criticality, we can show that this upper bound gets loose, and they're still bounded by L. They're still bounded by L, so in this case, we can say that the central limit theorem applies, and so the log of the Loschmidt taper, and this is pretty much a general and almost rigorous result, is distributed normally. Namely, the Loschmidt taper is called the log normal distribution. A log normal variable is a variable such that its log is normal. And now, actually, I have to say I'm pretty ignorant, but I'm finishing now. I have other things to say that I will not say. I didn't know, but if you study, if you go to Wikipedia, this is my main source of knowledge these days, if you go to Wikipedia, check for log normal, I know everybody. So log normal, you see that depending on the parameters of your distribution, namely its mean and its time average, and its, I'm sorry, and its variance, looks like either exponential or Gaussian. So that these two different regimes we found actually are just an outcome of a specific system, are just an outcome of being the Loschmidt taper being normal, log normally distributed. How about the Bach-Hund? How about criticality? Why things go wrong? Why the central limit theorem doesn't apply? This would be the something. Well, I can just say what fails there in a very nice way, it's in a very interesting way, that you don't have many terms. It looks like P0 is always order 1. when the system is off critical, all the other PNs are very small, and you have many of them that all together they give you the remain. You know, they have a, you have a summary. They got to give you one out of the P naught, and have many of them and very small. When you're close to criticality, since PN, if you look the formula somewhere, the perturbative formula suggests that somehow the PN should diverge when EN gets close to E0, right? And so it means that some of the PNs, say for the first excited state or the second excited state, they're very large. And all the others, so you have a sharp drop as a function of the energy eigenstate labeled N of the weight of the PNs. So it means that for criticality, what you have there is precisely just a few terms. And for example, one term. If you had one term, like P1, one frequency, well, you would have some, you have this sort of divergence. It's like Van Hove singularity. But actually, you can see, I can make this argument. Suppose now I have these few terms, and I'm replacing this time average, this not being the time average of this. I'm doing this. Now it's just making phase averages over the torus. This is precisely, if you think about it, this is precisely the density of state of the d-dimensional Hopping system. If you have a bunch of fermions in d-dimension, you look at the spectrum is this bunch of with inhomogeneous Hopping terms. Okay, you have these different Hopping amplitudes along the different directions, and they're just modulating the cosines. And this precisely the calculation you would have to do in order to get the density of state of that. So the probability distribution of the Lochner table close to criticality, where just few terms of this survive, namely n max or some number n, is precisely given by the density of state of a d-dimensional fermionic Hopping system. And now expert in the room would say, I know this, this is the Van Hove singularity, or if you have two terms, just two terms, you have this. The Bachmann hood, if we were really condensed matter guy, and we are not, as you can tell, we would have got it from the outset. We say, hey, this looks like the DOS of a two-dimensional Hopping system of fermions. There should be something behind it. And in particular, there are degenerate cases where this amplitude here, you know, this two divergent, actually the years are divergent, are logarithmically, so Bachmann has logarithmically diverging years, and we can compute those exactly. And actually you can devise systems like the HY model at the anisotropy transition for gamma equals zero, where it happens that these two peaks, they merge in a single, and so my student said, okay, this is the Mork. After the Bachmann hood, just this single here or like a Mohawk kind of thing. And that's it. Okay, I think I will stop it here. I think more or less you got the message and the kind of effort we were trying to do. And check the papers out and ask questions if you want. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions?
This density of states also has another interpretation as generating functions from random walk. So does it have any implication in the sense that as the state evolves, it's executing either one or two or three dimensional random walks and you are...
I haven't thought about this. Because
it's precisely the...
The generating function for... You mean this one? The sum of cosines with inhomogeneous weights?
If you take a lattice and look at the generating function.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Or random walks. This is closely related to
the
Higgs function.
I understand this because the single body Hopping Hamiltonian is describing a random walk, right? So on this d-dimensional lattice. Yeah. Now, I haven't thought about it. Let's make a short.
For the Lochschmidt Eckgard bits, you assume that the only assumption that you make is that the energy levels of a Hamiltonian are not degenerate.
For the only assumption I make in order to get what?
Which you get that result, the 2 over d plus 1 result.
Yeah, it is. If you don't do that, you find another formula. that I share with you is if each of the energy levels is dj times degenerate, you're going to find 1 plus some dj over d over d. So, or something like that. Okay? So, what I mean is that if this rate, so dj is the degeneracy, so probably there's a d here. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is saying that the violation of this rule, as long as your djs are much smaller than d, so namely none of the energy eigenstates gets a degeneracy that's comparable to the total inverse space dimension, this formula here is still pretty much true. It could be, you know, the scaling, you may get something that is larger and larger in the denominator, in the numerator, right? Naturally, if one of these guys here were exactly 1, of course, you don't have any evolution.
Yeah, so, but also if the DJs are small, but all of them are different from 0, you still get the violation. Imagine that all levels.
No? What if they are 1? If they are 1, I'm not sure now, I can't quite do the formula. Well, I don't have anything with me. But I get you the right formula to do something that you know. If they are 1, you get it precisely.
No, what I'm saying is.
Maybe there's a d square here. It should be.
If all the djs were 2. Mm-hmm. So the system, imagine the system is double.
No, I can't quite see right here, right now, but no, I don't think this is true. So maybe it's not just the formula. I just want to say, good question, we have the formula. The violation is like this. And anyways, this non-degeneracy really doesn't really matter at all. And you can check, right? These are exactly solvable systems. They have a lot of symmetries. They have a lot of degeneracy. You may have changes in the prefactor, but the 1 over d is what really matters. The fact that the expectation value of the Loschmidt equation is a small, the system size doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have to have one of these there would be really big. Right. Yeah, it's a part.
And the conditions on the quench for that formula to hold?
Which one?
Again, the 2 over d plus 1.
As far as I understand it, it's no condition. But like the Hamiltonian is bounded off. Actually, I think it's finite dimensionality. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Intermission Hamiltonian. How about it? Well, I know people out there that do crazy things. Yeah? I think it's fair, or at least this is the way. This is what we wrote in the paper.
But will there be difference between integrable and non-integrable?
No. I don't believe in this integrable, non-integrable thing. I don't believe in that. I know that people out there, they say that it makes a difference whether your system is integrable or not integrable, but at least for this sort of questions, I don't really see where integrability comes. Because look, quantum systems are always integrable in a sense, because what is an integrable system? It's like having a large number of commuting operators. Well, if you add locality, maybe a little more trickier, right? But the spectral projections are a complete set of commuting operators, and any density matrix in the fixed point can be written like in some generalized canonical form that is so popular these days, right? So, well, I don't think integrability, or at least we never saw but nevertheless, of course, since the question is very natural, we did all this for XY chain. Well, this is generalist theory, XY chain, and then of course we took care of adding some little tiny extra terms that, in order to make the Hamiltonian not integrable anymore, and the phenomenology was, I would say, precisely the same. So, and I have general. I'm convinced on general grounds that integrability shouldn't play. I don't know. I know there are people that they say that equilibration strongly depends. There are other people like me. And now we are in 2 camps, okay? And I got the stick. So.
Okay. Other questions? If not, let's thank Paul.